Testing. All right. Do you want to say something? Do you want to say test? Test.
Okay. Test. All
right, we're okay. Good.
So we are at Sam Winkler's house. My name is Marley Wirtz. It is Wednesday, February 24th of 2016, and the time is 3 p.m. And Sam, would you state your name?
Sam Winkler.
All right, thank you. So, Sam, where are you originally from?
I'm originally from Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Okay. And what brought you to Roanoke?
My job.
Your job. Okay. How was life growing up in Winston-Salem?
Well, actually, I was born in Winston, but I moved around a lot. So I lived in Winston. I lived in the mountainous area of North Carolina. So I was here, there, and everywhere. So I really didn't settle down completely until I moved to Roanoke. And I moved to Roanoke in 1981.
Okay. So what would you describe your childhood like with moving around?
Haphazard at best, because I came from a broken family. My mom and dad divorced when I was three, and so I just moved from kind of pillar to post. So I lived with my sister for a while, lived with my brother for a while, lived with my other sister for a while. Moved out on my own when I was a senior in high school. Worked on second shift, maintained an AB average, and got a scholarship and went to college.
That's remarkable. Wow. That's really great. So I would say that your childhood, would you say that your childhood kind of like made you work really hard to?
I think so. I think coming up that way, you kind of go that extra mile to try to go above and beyond what is expected of you.
Absolutely. So when you weren't in school and when you weren't working second shift, what were you doing? Like, what were your interests when you were in high school? And
basically, in high school, I didn't really have a lot of time for a lot of outside interests because, I was working things, trying to support myself, and went into the Air Force after high school. And, was an MP in the Air Force for a while.
And what's an MP?
Mm-hmm.
What is
I'm sorry. It's military police.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. So where did you go into the, like, where were you stationed, or where were you living when you went into the Air Force?
I was living in Winston-Salem.
You were living in Winston-Salem. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that, you said your career brought you to Roanoke, or your job brought you to Roanoke. Mm-hmm. So what job was that?
I started out as a color designer for furniture, and then from that I went into health, safety, and environmental work, and I did that for probably 25 years.
Wow. So are you now retired?
I just retired a year ago. Yes.
Congratulations. Yes. That's wonderful.
Yes.
So when you came to Roanoke in the 1980s, what would you describe it like?
I moved here in 1981, and Roanoke was a very interesting city at that time. For one thing, I had not ever lived anywhere where you had female impersonators on the street corner soliciting business, and this went on in Roanoke at that time. As a matter of fact, down around where Billy Ritz is, used to be called the Block, and as they started to clean up that area, they pushed them farther and farther out. But it was I can remember being at work, and one of the girls at office said, be careful if you go downtown and pick up a female. And I'm like, why? And they said, because it might not be a female. I'm like, okay, I understand. But I got involved actually in the leather community. Almost as soon as I came into Roanoke, there was a leather club called the Centurions, which I was a member of, and was a member of that for quite some time. I was president for a while, I was road captain for a while, and learned a lot about the leather lifestyle. And it's interesting because a lot of people automatically assume that the leather lifestyle was S&M and that could be farther from the truth. I mean, just like any other aspect of life, there's that group of people, but for the most part, that was not at all what the leather community was about. And I guess probably the best way that I could describe it, and this is, I used to write for this paper, this was called Shout, which was a gay newspaper in Roanoke. And basically, a statement that I made many, many years ago is leather is a state of mind. It's a feel, a smell, a taste, and a fashion statement of the person wearing it. Leather is new, it's different, it's erotic, and it's adventurous. Leather has no age, race, gender, sexual orientation, or physical and appearance boundaries. People in every lifestyle and profession, gay and straight, store clerks to lawyers, are interested and involved in the leather lifestyle. And just to show you how much I've changed over the years, that was me when I used to write for the paper.
Wow. I like it. So you were the president. Is that what that says?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah.
That's interesting. And so how old were you when that was happening?
I was 28, 29, and I was part of the leather community up until about 10 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. What kind of things does the Leather Club do?
Okay. Basically, it's a group of people that like to get together and party together. We had what we called runs, and you could have had an outside run, which was more like a camping trip, if you can imagine 100 guys at a camping trip. Or sometimes they were held in hotels. We've had them before at Patrick Henry. We've had them at Sheraton. And the different clubs have cocktail parties. So it's basically one big party from Friday afternoon until about noon on Sunday.
Wow.
So a lot of fun, a lot of getting to meet new people and things. And I will tell you that probably the leather community over the years changed. When I first became involved in the leather community, there was a lot of respect for the elder people that were in the leather community. They were kind of like your, you would respect your grandfather or your father. You know, they taught you the true ways of the leather community. And for example, if you had a master's cap, which is what that is called, you didn't just go out and buy that, you know. You earned it.
Mm-hmm.
When someone felt it was time that you had proven yourself in the community, that was presented to you. Today, it's more of a, hey, let's go out and get us a cap, you know. Also, people back then were very particular about their master's cap. If you came up and said, hey, I want to wear your master's cap, it would have been an automatic no. You're not. You know, you didn't earn it, you're not wearing it. As a matter of fact, I probably would not have even let most people try mine on. Just because of the respect that I had and the work that goes into to earning it. But it has changed. It's changed, and a lot of the leather clubs now are dwindling away. And a lot of the reason for that is because of the internet. People don't really need leather clubs to meet people of like persuasion because they go online, you know, and you can find anybody you want online just real quick. So because of that, a lot of your younger people are no longer interested in the leather clubs. And it was really a shame to see them kind of dwindle because they were a lot of fun. They were a lot of fun. Did a lot of traveling. I'll just give you an example. That's my leather vest. And each one of these represents either a club, another leather club, or a leather run that I went to. And I was also, at one time, I was the president of the Southeast Conference of Clubs, which was 32 leather clubs. So.
Wow.
That's just one vest. And then there's another one.
But some leather guys ride bikes. That's what I used to ride. And just to give you an idea of that was like dress uniform. And like I said, you had cocktail parties. I was going to show you some. And you did crazy things like we did. We had a leather run at at Patrick Henry, and for our cocktail party, our opening cocktail party, we did a takeoff on Gone with the Wind, where everybody that was in the club, for the most part, dressed as somebody from Gone with the Wind. Just to give you an example. And that was me as Belle Watley, Madam of the Whorehouse. So, like I said, it was just a lot of fun. Just some more examples of the banquet that we always had. And you would have anywhere from 10 to 15 cocktail parties. They'd start like on Friday afternoon. And they'd go until 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning. And then they'd start at breakfast the next morning with eye openers. And a lot of fun. I think probably one of the most fun times I ever had, I went to a run in Washington, D.C., and one of the clubs, we had it at the, I can't remember the name of the hotel, but it was right downtown Washington, and they decided their cocktail party, they were going to do Ethel Merman bathing beauties. So if you can imagine a bunch of guys in one-piece bathing suits trying to, so, but it's just kind of almost like college fraternity type stuff. Same thing is true with leather curls.
How did you find out about the Leather Club?
I was involved with someone before I moved to Roanoke that was into the Leather Clubs, and they basically brought me into the Leather Clubs. And then when I moved to Roanoke, I found out there was a club here, and so I joined the club here. And that club eventually disbanded, and then there was another club called the Rogues. Which is where the patch on my vest is from. And you could be associate members of clubs from other states or whatever, like Code 12 was a club in Jacksonville, Florida that I was an associate member of. And so I traveled quite a bit. I mean, I'd ride my bike. It wasn't anything unusual for me to ride to New York on my motorcycle and Ohio and just wherever. And pack everything you'd want for like a whole week on the back of a motorcycle and take off for the weekend. So it was a lot of fun.
And you said that hat that you had to earn, that hat. What types of things like did you do?
For one thing, you had to learn about the history of the leather clubs. And there is a very deep history of the leather clubs. As a matter of fact, there's a leather archives in Chicago that has a lot of the first club's information and things like that. And I think for me, the big thing was learning that you do not automatically assume that just because somebody is, quote, in a leather club that they're into, I want to tie you up and beat you and all of this, because it couldn't be more from the truth. Granted, like I said, there's people out there like that. But there's people out there like that in every aspect of life that, you know, that's their thing. And I tend to try to stay away from that kind of people because that's not me at all. I'm more into sharing and having a good time and just enjoying, as opposed to the, and I did a lot of demonstrations. Now I say that I wasn't in the pain, and I really wasn't, but I have a paddle that it used to be if I went to the bar or somewhere, everybody wanted to take one hit from Daddy Sam with the paddle. That is my paddle. And all of those are names of people that have, at one time or another, taken at least one whack from the paddle. Once again, a whole lot like a fraternity in college, where, you know, you have somebody that's your frat master or whatever, and they're going to be in charge of the paddle or whatever. And I really don't know when I started being called Daddy Sam, but that kind of came up. And as you can see, the paddle was engraved Daddy Sam. And I used to do some demonstrations with fire. I knew they would get you. Fire play is one of the oldest tricks in the world. It's an old circus trick. And I was taught to do it. And people used to love to have me set them on fire. And it's does something for me, and it does something for them too. Number one, for you to trust me enough to set you on fire and not let you burn, kind of strokes my ego a little bit, because that says you really trust me, you know? But on the other hand, that person too has to put complete trust in you. That, you know, because basically what you would do is, and it was really awesome in a bar, because you would clear the pool table, usually is where I did it a lot of times, and we would put something over the top of the pool table, and the person would take their shirt off, and I would light their back on fire. And then I'd take my hand and cup it like that and put it out.
That's amazing.
Haven't done it in a lot of years. Don't know that I would even attempt to do it again because it has been that long. But the secret to it was, and the way I was taught, there was a lady that taught me how to do it. And I was at a leather run. And I saw her setting somebody on fire, and I thought, that is so cool. You know, that whole person's back is just flaming, and they weren't burned at all. And I said, I want to try that. So she laid me down, and she sprayed my back and set me on fire. It got a little warm, and I started to raise up, and she pushed me back down. She said, don't worry, because she started talking to somebody. She said, whether I put it out or not, it's going to go out before it burns you. And the reason for that is it's done with like a very low percent grade of alcohol, so it flashes real quick. But for people in the room that have never seen it, they don't know that. They just know that, you know, I've set somebody on fire. And I've done, you know, I put it in my hand and lit my hand and did this number and waved it around the room and everything. But it doesn't burn because there is, now you have to be careful. And this is one thing that I believed in when any time that I did a demonstration is I would always tell people, do not go home and try this. Because if you don't know what you're doing, you can hurt somebody. You know, if you just go to the grocery store and buy any grade of alcohol, and think, oh, Sam did this, I can do this, and spray somebody's back, and you light a match to it, you're going to hurt them. And so I'd always say, don't do it. You know, number one, don't even attempt to do it unless you've had it done to you. Because you have to be able to know the sensation that the person's going to feel before you can respect their limits of what they're going to feel. But it was kind of like, it wasn't even like you would get really warm, because I think it was like a 2 or 3% alcohol, so very low-grade alcohol. And you told the person, too, you know, you made sure they laid perfectly flat, and you made sure it didn't puddle on their back. And what I'd use is like a mist bottle, like you mist plants with, mist the back so that it was just little beads of alcohol. And then when you light it, it's going to go up in blue flame, just like that. And then, like I said, I'd immediately just take my hand and cup it, hold it out, put it out like that. It was kind of neat. It was kind of neat.
Kind of. Sounds incredible. Really cool.
And that's really when people really started calling me, I guess, Daddy Sam then. And probably another thing that really came about that started me being called Daddy Sam was the murder that happened in Roanoke. And I can't remember the year, but there was a situation where somebody from out of town walked into Corn Beef and Company and got directions to the park. And when they gave them directions, just like anybody would, and as they walked out the door, the guy made a comment, "I'm going to go kill a bunch of faggots." Well, they immediately called the police. Well, the police went to the park thinking that's where this guy's going because that's where he got directions to. But he did not go to the park. He went to the little bar on Salem Avenue called Back Street. Walked in, sat down, had a beer with several people, stood up and just fired point blank and shot seven people. And killed one. And then right after that, there was a candlelight vigil. And there was probably close to 600 or 700 people that met in Elmwood Park. And they had called me and asked me, as the leader of the leather community, if I would lead the parade. Well, I was kind of young and foolish, and I'm like, sure, I will. And I went down that night dressed in full leather, and I had my leather pride flag and everything, and I'm thinking, this isn't smart. You are right out in the front of this whole crowd. There's just been a murder in Roanoke, and you would be easy shot for anybody. But nothing happened that night. The police were fantastic. They blocked it off. Salem Avenue we came out of Elmwood Park onto Salem Avenue, and the march went from there up Salem Avenue to where Backstreet Bar is, and that's where the candlelight vigil was held. But that's also, I guess, when I started having a whole lot more to do with a lot of the other aspects of the gay community, because a couple of the female impersonators were there, and at that point everybody was a little standoffish from Daddy Sam, because I mean, that can be intimidating, you know, if you see me and I've got like a whip on my side and all of that. But once you got to know me, it was like, no, He's just like anybody else, you know. He just has a good time. He's not going to, without you wanting him to. And even if somebody wanted me to tie him up and beat him, I don't think I could have ever done it. I'm just not that kind of person. But I would hit him with a paddle once. but that's probably when I started being called Daddy Sam. And it got to the point that I could even go into the bar, and when I walk in the bar, somebody would shout, "Daddy Sam's here," and especially at Back Street, because it was a small little community-type bar. And that's where I did a lot of the demos and everything. But then I kind of got out of it. I met my partner, and he really wasn't into the leather world that much. And I think it's just like anything else. You go down so many paths in your life, and you go down one path for a while, and then your life will take another turn, and you'll go down a different path. And I think that was true with me. We met and wanted to build a life together and everything, and I felt like any time that you're going to be involved in a relationship, you probably should not be spending a lot of time in a bar. Be it a gay relationship, a straight relationship, or any other kind of relationship, bars tend to breed trouble because there's always that other person that's going to try to make the person you're with jealous. You know, they may not really want you themselves, but they're going to do something to try to just prove that, oh, well, I can get them. And so we pretty much got to the point that we did not go to the bars. Don't go to the bars. Haven't been to the bar. Well, we've been together 9 years, and I think we've been to the bar maybe twice since we've been together, three times since we got together. But looking back on the last 9 years, I would not give up those 9 years for all the years that I spent going to the bar. He is, without a doubt, if ever I had a soulmate, he is my soulmate. And we met online. There was a thing called Bear 411. And it's just kind of like a chat room. And we started chatting. And we talked for a year before we ever met each other. And we got to the point we talked every day, either on the computer, by phone, or whatever. Then he was from West Virginia, and he was living in North Carolina, and he was going up to his family reunion, and he said, well, I'll just stop and spend a weekend so we can finally meet, because we hadn't in a year. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. And so he came up, and we had a great weekend, and it was like you weren't meeting a stranger, because you've talked for a year. So you really knew a lot about each other, you know, what your likes were and your dislikes and everything. And it was funny because I was coming in from work and he was coming across the Walnut Street Bridge. And he called me and he said, I think I'm lost. And I said, okay, what are you driving? And he said, a blue van. And I said, well, if you see that red truck that just pulled out in front of you, that would be me. So just follow me home. And he did. He spent Friday night and Saturday night, and Sunday morning he got up and got ready to go to his family reunion. And just on a whim, I said, if you don't mind, I'll go with you. And he's like, I did tell you this is a West Virginia family reunion. I said, yes. And I said, but I went with him to his family reunion, so I met his whole family in one day. And it was funny because his mom and dad did not know, probably for 3 or 4 years, that was the first weekend we'd ever seen each other. They'd assumed that we'd been dating. And we got to talking one night, and we're like, no. That was the first weekend we had seen each other also. And then 5 years ago, we had a commitment service in North Carolina. And then as soon as Virginia made it legal in Virginia, I was out of town on business, and I called him. I said, let's get married. So we got married January the 10th, 2015, and just celebrated our 1 year official anniversary. And as far as I'm concerned, we'll be together forever.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's really exciting. I was actually going to ask if you were married. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask if you were married.
Yes. Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yes. And we both share a lot of the same likes. We're both into gardening, as you can probably tell by looking at the yard out here in the front and everything. We go to the lake quite a bit. And so we jokingly tell people, the majority of our friends are not really gay. They're straight people. Because we don't really think of our lifestyle as quote, I know some people say, well, there's a gay lifestyle and a straight lifestyle. Our lifestyle is our lifestyle, you know. We have Christmas parties, and it's a mix of people. Like I said, I'm into gardening. I'm a master gardener. I do therapeutic gardening with nursing homes and all of that. And he's into Christmas lights, so he does a whole shopping center in North Carolina by himself. And just to give you an idea, when I say we're kind of into Christmas, we had 15 Christmas trees throughout the house. Like I said, your path, you know, you go down a different path. And I don't miss the leather clubs. I don't regret being in the leather clubs. I thoroughly enjoyed it when I was in them. I made a lot of great friends there. But I think as you get older, there's kind of this thing of when you become an adult, you put away childish things. Well, I think I finally became an adult and put away my childish things and settled down to being a real adult and contributing person to the community.
So, do you still have any friends that you made? Do you still keep in touch with some friends that you made in the leather
club? Oh, yes. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, some of them were our wedding. And it was funny, because when we started sending out invitations for the wedding, I told Mark, I said, don't worry about how many you send, because only 50% is going to show up. 95% showed up. And we had it here. We left all the Christmas decorations up. We took all the furniture out of the living room and all the furniture out of the dining room, rented chairs and had it set up like a chapel. Ended up with three ministers, because the couple that had did our commitment in North Carolina wanted to be a part of it, but they were not, their license wasn't recognized in Virginia because they're in North Carolina. So we had to get a minister in Virginia to do the officiating and actually pronounce husband and husband, but they could still do a part of it too. So we ended up with three ministers. I said, well, if we're not married now, we'll never be.
Wow. So you mentioned Backstreet Cafe. Was that like one of your go-to or one of your favorite bars to go to, or was the
bar? Actually, that was just a little small neighborhood type bar. And yes, that's probably the one I went to a lot. There used to be another one called The Last Straw, which was right on the corner of Salem and Jefferson when I first moved to Roanoke, and it eventually closed. I'm not real big into the large dance bars. I like small community-type bars where you can sit and carry on a conversation, and you get to know people, and you don't feel like you're screaming to talk to each other all the time, you know. And I always felt that way, sort of, when I went to the park. It's because it was loud dance music, and you know, you'd be bah, 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 bah. And you really couldn't really connect with people. I didn't think you go and you dance and have a good time and then you got home. But in the smaller bars, there was always that opportunity to just sit one-on-one, kind of like what we're doing right now, and just sit and talk, you know, about anything and everything.
Again, you mentioned that gentleman went into corned beef, and the police found out that he was going to do that heinous act. So what was the relationship like with the police back in the 80s?
Actually, very good. Like I said, that was evident to me in the night that we had the candlelight vigil. They blocked all the side streets. They were very respectful to everyone, and everyone was very respectful to them. I was amazed.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Because you're talking back, oh, geez, this had to have been 20 years ago, maybe, or longer. Did this happen? And they got the guy. I mean, because they got him within two or three blocks of Back Street. But actually what the police did, when they found out that he was going to the park, they went to the park and would not allow anyone in the park to leave because they didn't know where he was. Mm-hmm. And so they basically locked it down. And it was good because those people were safe inside because the police were pretty much all around that place that night.
So did they ever figure out his motive behind anything?
Supposedly, his motive was that his last name was Gay and that he had been harassed all of his life because of his last name. And, you know, do I buy that story? Not at all. Not at all. I'm sorry, but that's just not a reason to go in and kill somebody in cold blood. And then, I mean, he didn't even know these people. Had never seen these people. It wasn't like there'd been any kind of confrontation with them or anything. He just, like I said, went in, sat at the table with them, had a beer, and got up, and they assumed he was going to leave, and he got up and just point blank.
So after that happened, were people afraid to go out to, like, was there a lull in the nightlife?
Actually, no, there wasn't. Because they caught him that night. It wasn't like it was days or anything. I mean, they got him probably within four blocks of Back Street. Because they had a good description of him and everything. So, you know, they were right on top of it. But no, I think if anything, it was just the opposite. And pretty much it's the same that I feel today, that you can't let, in our day and time today, you can't lock yourself in the house because you're afraid there might be a terrorist on a street corner. I mean, you guys especially, because I was telling somebody the other day, I said, you know, it's sad that our kids today can't go to college and get a college education without worrying about some idiot that might come in and start shooting for no reason at all, because it's happened. And for no reason. So I think today is worse than it was then. Because I think we kind of said, we're not going to stay home. You know, we're not going to lock our doors and not go out and everything. And so we went back out. The one nice thing that I will say that happened, there, and I can't remember the minister's name, but there was a minister about the same time that was going all over the United States and was causing a lot of problems, like if there was a gay situation or something, and he was saying that people were basically getting what they deserved. So, and I can't remember his name, but to protect this guy's family when they had the funeral, there was a row of people that stood with white sheets and held them up so that the media nor this minister, because this minister had said he was coming to town the day of the funeral, because we had all gone through some training about what not to do. You know, do not touch him, because that's what he wanted. Because he would have had everybody right where he wanted them then. If say you had been him and I would have as much as put my hand on you, then he would have cried foul, you know, they're attacking me. So we went through a night of training of do not touch them, ignore them, don't get into any kind of verbal confrontation with them or anything. Just try to block it out of your mind. Unfortunately, he did not come to town, but he had said he was going to. And I can't remember his name. It was a minister. It was about, I can't remember, because it was way after the Ryan White situation, but I can't remember his name. But he did. He was causing problems all over the United States, and trying to say that it was the gay population was the ones causing the problems. So. What else?
Are there any experiences that did make you just want to, you know, someone similar to that ministered? Were there any experiences that you faced where you just had to speak up, you had to do something about it, where someone was just discriminating against you because of who you were or who you are?
It's funny you ask that. Like I said, I was in the parade, or in that candlelight vigil march at night, and as I walked the street, I thought, this isn't smart. Because you're going to be on the news, and everybody at work is going to be watching the news. So I watched the news, and I wasn't on the news. I thought, whew, good, you know. And then the next morning, I got a newspaper on the way to work and opened the newspaper, and there I was. Full leather, carrying a little pride flag. And I'm like, no, 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 no. And I thought, how do I handle this? And I kept looking at the paper thinking, don't look like me. Didn't look like me. And I'd look again. And I'm, yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. There's no doubt who that is, you know. And, but I went on to work, and I thought about it, and I just decided that if I was confronted, I was just going to basically say, what I do in my private life is my business. It has no bearing on my job. You know, I still do the same job and that I always did. And it was strange because nobody said a word. And I worried about it all day, but nobody said a word all day long. About 2 weeks later, one of the guys walked up to me and he said, saw your picture in the paper. And I said, and? He said, what you do in your life is your business, nobody else's. But that's the only time that I've really worried about it. And I'm a very fortunate person. And my partner's a very fortunate person because both families know. Both families are very accepting. When we got married, his mom, well, his dad has passed away, but his mom was here, and my sister was here. And we basically did a Western-type wedding. And when he came down the steps, he turned and handed his cowboy hat to his mom. And then she took his arm and walked across the living room and stood beside of him. And when I came down, I handed mine to my sister and did the same. And so it's and even before his dad passed away, his dad was always very accepting. His dad always called me son-in-law. And it was funny because he had to go to the hospital for open heart surgery, and Mark had not been here that long, and he called me, and he said, how do I get to Charlottesville? And I'm like, why are you going to Charlottesville? He said, they're rushing my dad in an ambulance to UVA. I said, well, you're not driving. I'll be home in 10 minutes. And so I put him in my car, and we took off to Charlottesville. And it was strange because I don't know if you believe in premonition or anything like that, but we stopped at a rest area and went and used the bathroom. We came out and I saw an ambulance go by. And I said, there goes your dad in that ambulance. And I said, I'm catching it. He said, you'll get a ticket. I said, not unless they follow me to Charlottesville, I won't, because I'm not stopping. And we pulled in right behind the ambulance, and it was his dad. And so they got his dad out of the ambulance, and Mark went in with him and everything. And then I went and parked and came back and went to the room, and the nurse said, well, you must be his other son, I said, no, I'm his son-in-law. And Mark's dad looked and grinned. He said, yeah, he's my son-in-law. And he called me son-in-law from then on. So we're very fortunate. There's a lot of people even today, and it's sad. There's a lot of people today that can't come out to their families. Or if they do come out to their families, they don't really want to have anything to do with them anymore. And we don't have that problem. My whole family knows. His whole family knows. I go to family reunions. He goes to my families and everything. And I think that's the way it should be. You know, it's not a matter of straight and straight or gay and gay or whatever. It's a matter of this is the person that I love. This is the person I want to share my life with. Don't make me choose between the person I love and my family. Because if you do, you're going to lose. If you make me choose, I guarantee you, you're going to lose. Because I'm not going to give up the man that I love, the man I've spent 9 years of my life with, for anybody. And that's just the way I feel.
Absolutely. So would you say that discrimination towards the gay community is worse now than it was when you were?
No.
No.
No. I do not think you have the discrimination today that you would have had 20 years ago even. And I'll be honest with you. I think somebody that really helped that is Ellen DeGeneres. I mean, I can remember when she first was outed, she was ostracized. I mean, they pulled her off of TV. They did all these things. You know, nobody wanted to do anything. And look at her today. And look at like a lot of your actors and things. They're no longer afraid to say, I'm gay, or I've gotten married, or whatever. You can pick up any magazine and start looking like, and it'll say, so-and-so got married. I'm like, oh, we've come a long way. We've come a long way. A lot farther, really, than I would have ever thought would happen in my life. And I think it was time. I worry now because of who's running for president. And I won't mention any names, but I don't think anyone could turn the wheels back. I don't think America would stand for it. And, you know, we went through this whole thing of the evangelical group saying that if you allow gays to get married, it's going to hurt the straight lifestyle. No, it's not. Why? How? To us, the way we looked at, and we didn't even, we used to talk about this a lot. We did not care if you called it marriage or if you called it commitment, or whatever you wanted to call it, that was fine. What we wanted was equal rights. You know, if I went into a hospital, I wanted to know that Mark, as my husband, had a right to say, this is what you do. And until they decided this, he really didn't. I had to have a power of attorney for that. And that's not right. I mean, just like if either of you, for example, were in a relationship with someone and you were in that relationship for 20 years, that person should be able to have a say in your health. Whether you've got a little piece of paper that says you're married or not married, I always said, you know, a piece of paper doesn't make a marriage. It doesn't break a marriage and it doesn't make a marriage. And so that's what I really always pushed for was, I don't care what you call it. I mean, even today, I will tell you this. I have called him husband more with you two than I have called him in a year, because I have a hard time with that. I call him my partner usually, but I have a hard time calling him my husband. But basically, if you look on our marriage certificate, that's exactly what it says. Husband. But to me, and that's probably just me, I don't know that America's ready for husband, husband, wife, wife. Although they seem to be. I mean, they don't really seem to be having a lot of problem with it. You hear Patrick Harris, for example, calls his other person in his life husband. And Ellen calls the person in her life wife. But I just have a hard time with it. It's easier for me to say partner than this is my husband. I guess because that's the way I was brought up, you know.
So I want to go back just a little bit. You mentioned your family and how fortunate you are to have them know.
And it hasn't always been an easy road. When I came home from the Air Force, I came out to my sister, who told my mom, and my dad had already passed away at that time, and my mom called, and she said, well, my sister told me she had told my mom. Let me go back. And so mom called, and I said, well, I guess you called to talk about what sis told you. She said, what? And I said, that I'm gay. She said, she didn't tell me nothing like that. And I'm like, oh. So mother was kind of funny with it for a long, long time. She wanted to know who was the man and who was the woman. I said, no. It don't work that way. You don't have to have a man and a woman. We're equal partners. And she said, well, I just don't understand. I said, well, I know that. And I said, and I don't really expect you to understand. And my mom lived in California, and it was so funny because I remember a statement that she said, I don't understand it, but I know there's a lot of them that live out here. I said, yes, there is. And so at that time, my partner and I went to visit, and she was going to give me my old bedroom and him the guest room. And I sat her down, and I said, Mother, we need to have a talk. We share a house together. We share a bed together at home. If you and my stepdad came to my house, I would not put you in one room and him in another room. She said, well, no. I said, well, then, why are you doing it to me? And she thought, sat there for a minute, and she said, you're right. It doesn't make any sense, does it? If you do this together at home, and I'm one of those people, I'm very respectful of people's feelings. I mean, you will never see us out in public with me, with my arm around him either. I don't do that. I don't like to see heterosexual overly affectionate in public. I think there's a time and a place for everything. And I don't think public is, you know, I want to come up sometimes and say, you need to get a room. And I feel the same with couples that are gay. I think too many times people want to try to push it down somebody's throat. You know, you have to accept us. Well, maybe if you'd ease up a little bit, they'll accept you a whole lot better. But yeah, it was kind of rough for a little while with my family. Had a brother it was really rough with. His first thought was he was going to kidnap me and beat me straight. And I'm like, don't think so. I said, it just doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. You know, I am who I am. I'm still the same. If you met me today and didn't know, I'd still be me. What I do, and I tell people this, what I do behind that door is my business. What I do on the other side of that door is part of your business because that's public, you know, and that's just kind of the way I look at it. It doesn't matter what you do behind closed doors. That's each individual person. So
you went to visit your mom in California. How old were you when?
When I told her?
Yes.
24, 25, something like that.
Well, that's wonderful that she's so accepting. Is your mother still?
No, she's passed away.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah. But my sister and all accept. My niece's nephews call Mark uncle. As a matter of fact, my niece probably talks to him more than she does me. And just a very good relationship all the way around. His family's the same way. We had a little problem with one member of his family. He had an uncle that would call and invite Mark to Christmas socials. Wouldn't say, you and Sam come, he'd just say, you come. And Mark finally told his daughter, he said, until he says, you and Sam, I'm not coming. So we're going this coming weekend because we got a call the other day and he said, we want Sam and you to come for a social at the house. So, mark another one off. I think that's the way the world's moving. I think as people get more educated, they're more accepting. I had somebody tell me, and there's a lot of truth to this, people who tend to not leave more than 25 miles from home tend to have a very narrow perspective. Especially if you happen to be from this area, you know, and you've never traveled or anything, and you have always lived here in the quote-unquote Bible Belt, and you've got those blinders, and, you know, there's no gray area. It's all got to be black and white. But if you talk to people that have gone to school and that are educated and things, that opens up a whole new world, I think, to everybody.
Absolutely. So coming to Roanoke and being in the Leather Club and having a huge influence on you, and then after you met your partner, so you decided to stay in Roanoke because of work or just because you liked Roanoke still as a community?
Well, I didn't retire until last year, but I do like Roanoke. Of everywhere I've ever lived, I like Roanoke the best. I had never lived around mountains until I moved to Roanoke. And I don't know if everyone liked living around the mountains or not, you know. And my mom used to always say, well, you need to move to California. And I'm like, no. Too many people. And I joke with Mark every now and then. I'm like, we ought to sell the house and move to Florida since I've retired. And he said, really? And I said, no, not really. Not really. I don't really want to do that. I love Roanoke. And I love the people in Roanoke. We have a lot of friends here. We have a lot of friends that are in the Winston-Salem area where Mark was living. A lot of artist friends and things down there. And it's a couple hours and we're down there, a couple hours and they can be up here. So it's just, I can't see us living anywhere else.
So my last question, how would you, since you were in Roanoke from, you came here in 81, how would you just, in short summary, describe living in Roanoke from 81 until now? It doesn't have to be short, of course.
A life full of adventures. From the day I moved here up through this morning when I told Mark good morning. A life full of adventure. nothing that I would really want to change. I've enjoyed it, and I just look forward to spending the rest of my life here.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you much for your time, Sam. We cannot thank you enough, and just thank you for letting us hear all about your experiences
here in Verona. You're welcome.
Really, really appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.